Shall we start this party? All right. Okay, well, congratulations, everyone, on making it to Saturday afternoon. It's been very invigorating, and also, we're dealing with sobering times, and that's part of why we're all here. I feel like this, if you all were in the lunch session, I feel like that was a really good segue to this conversation we're going to have here, because this session is all about collaboration. It's called Reimagining Environmental Journalism in a Perilous Era, but it's also called a makerspace, but I think we could have also called it mutual aid. It's a lot about what we can imagine and organize together as journalists and as people affiliated with journalists. So I'm Madeline Ostrander. I am the co-organizer of this workshop with my colleague Michael Bradbury, who's footing it around the back there. We're here this afternoon to get our imaginations rolling and go on kind of an idea-generating journey that we hope will lead to some practical things that we can do together. And before we get to all of that, I want to have some real talk for a second about where we are. I think we've done a fair bit of that as well, so I can make it a little shorter, but I also want to say a bit about what the goals of this workshop are. So I'm a freelance climate journalist. Before that, I was an editor at Yes Magazine, which is a nonprofit. Last year, I was a fellow at the Knight Science Journalism Program at MIT, and I had a chance with the 10 other fellows who were there to talk a lot about the shared struggles we were facing, whether we were at newsrooms or freelancing or working internationally. And, you know, that just got me thinking a lot about what we can do together when we collaborate. And then after the November election, like literally the day after, I woke up and I had this feeling like I need to organize something. And I had this very galvanizing set of thoughts. And it turned out that they're the thoughts I think that a lot of us are having. And I brainstormed these thoughts with my co-organizer, Michael. And the workshop is kind of the answer to those thoughts. And one, these are going to be maybe a little obvious, but I'm going to give you some a few statistics that I find useful to keep in my mind, although they're a little sobering. One is that, of course, if we're going to have a chance of making it through both a crisis of democracy and a climate crisis, one thing we really need is stronger journalism. And I have been looking at some data from the local news initiative at Metal at Northwestern. So some of us know these intuitively, but still the numbers are pretty stark. Since 2005, more than 3,200 newspapers have closed across the United States. One in six Americans lives in a place with limited access to local news, and there are 206 counties that are completely dry news deserts with no local news at all. And that lack of journalism is shaping people's perceptions in very tangible ways. In those news deserts, for instance, Metal charted that Trump won by an average of 54 percentage points, so by not just a landslide, but as they put it, an avalanche. So there's a really direct relationship between the journalism that people are able to access and the choices that they make. And we're going to talk some about news deserts in a moment here, some of our panelists. I'm sure we all know that public trust in the media is at an all-time low. And so, I mean, I think it's clear no one's going to fight to protect journalism if we don't do it ourselves. But we have a lot of resources that we can, together, that we can access. And then I think it's also clear that one of the most important overarching roles of journalism is to help our audiences understand that they're part of communities and that we have choices to make together. And people are really hungry for this. Kyle, who's sitting next to me, is going to talk about this, but there's some really exciting reports they've been working with about how a wide majority of people in the U.S. and around the world support policies that promote climate solutions. And one thing I experience when I give talks at various forums is that people are really craving a way to come together and come up with shared solutions and feel empowered. But I think it's hard for us as journalists to help people with that when we ourselves are trapped in cycles of scarcity and feeling burnout. And so the goal here is, like, do not despair, but let's come together and pool the kinds of expertise and creativity and resources that we can tap into. And in the first half of this workshop, we're going to hear from these four very inspiring people who've done a lot of out-of-the-box thinking about how we can come together and make journalism stronger. And we've asked each of them to focus on a particular challenge that journalism is facing. And the idea here is that their work will give us some inspiration and some models that we can tap into. I also want to let you know there's a QR code sitting around here. We've put together a resource guide. And if you scan the QR code, you can access the resource guide. It's a whole set of links about a really wide variety of topics to do with different kinds of issues that we're facing, from legal support to funding models. And you can also, if you can't get to that, I attached it to a page on my website just because that was easier. It's at madelineostrander.com/resources, so you can type that in. So we're going to talk. And then in the second half, we're going to lead you through this process of generating ideas that we can organize together. And we have some pastries in the back, but if you take a pastry, it's like a social contract that you have to stay with us for the second half. So we'll bring those out in the second half. And meanwhile, stay with us. And I'm going to start with Kyle Pope. And in the interest of time, I'm going to give everyone a super quick introduction and let you read about their really wonderful work in the agenda. But Kyle is the co-founder and the executive director of strategic initiatives at Covering Climate Now. And the question we ask Kyle to wrestle with is, how do we make climate journalism pay right now?
We need money. Money. Thank you. It's really great to be here. Just quickly, for those of you who don't know, Covering Climate Now was started 5 years ago out of the Columbia Journalism School, where I worked and ran the Columbia Journalism Review. And we started this as a collaboration to help newsrooms what they want and what they need to do a better job of covering climate. We initially started it with the idea that we would hopefully attract a few dozen newsrooms, particularly in the United States, to work with each other, to collaborate with each other. And then it grew, and we have now more than 500 newsrooms around the world on every continent. And we do a ton of training, we do a ton of collaboration, and it's all free to all these newsrooms. We're a nonprofit. So that's who we are. So one of the things that we've done just in the last week that we've been working on for quite a while, and if you're a watcher of Covering Climate Now, I apologize because we've been hitting your email inbox hard on this stuff, but it's relevant to what we're talking about today because several months ago, we started looking at different bits of peer-reviewed research, examining what percentage of the people in the world care about climate change and want their governments to do something about it. And the numbers that we saw surprised us. They were between 80 and 89% of the people on Earth care about climate change. It's less in some countries, it's more in others, it's about 74% in the United States, it's more in other countries, but it was astonishing because it told us that, for me, I look at a lot of this through a kind of media prism, and I just thought a lot of the coverage of climate has a tone of defensiveness and a little bit of tone of fear and a little bit of tone of people in retreat, and that's not true. So what we decided to do was put all this research together and then go to newsrooms around the world and said, hey, here's the number for your country, here's the number for your community. For those of you who follow the work that Yale does in terms of their polling on climate, it's really excellent. It's very precise. You can look up by your market and look at what people think about climate, what do they want to do about it, what do they believe in, what do they not believe in. Anyway, we went to newsrooms around the world and said, could you just report on this fact? Could we all, in this last week in April now, just do stories about this 89%? So we launched something called the 89% Project, launched this week. We came up with a logo, we came up with a website, and we told people, just do stories on the 89% in your community. What does it mean? Who are these people? Who are the 11%? What does this look like in your community? Are there community-grown initiatives? Is there a democracy deficit? Are there political leaders who aren't responding to the fact that the majority of people think this? Are they passing legislation that goes against it? Why are they doing that? Who are those people? What do they have to say for themselves? So we launched it this week. It's a year-long project. Anybody who wants to participate is welcome. There's a website called 89%.org. You can go on there. You can look at the stories that were produced. I just saw some numbers yesterday. Newsrooms from 20 countries published into this project. Dozens and dozens and dozens of news stories. A lot on social media. And it's all just reinforcing this idea that people care about climate. They want to know more information about this. They want their governments to do more. And relevant to this conversation, they want the news outlets that they care about to be reporting on this. So don't let editors tell you that climate is a story that turns people off. Don't let editors tell you that it's a downer. Don't let editors tell you that people aren't willing to pay for climate news, because it's just not true. People care, and they want this information. And so what we were trying to do is aimed as much at newsrooms and gatekeepers in newsrooms as it is at the general public. And so what we're going to do over the next year is take all this data, look at what people reported, look at what regions of the country reported on it, look at what parts of the world reported on it, look at the stories. And if you go to that website, it's like an amazing, beautiful variety of stuff. People looking at schools, they're looking at like the psychology of climate, they're looking at food, they're looking at indigenous communities, a huge range of stories. And then we're going to do a series of webinars, and then we're going to do another big week of coverage and a big push before the COP in Brazil in the fall. So I'm not going to talk a lot longer. We can talk more about that in detail. But if you just think about what that means, it's going to feed into a lot of the other stuff that we're going to talk about. Because if you absorb this fact that most people want more information about that and that they care about this, it means that there has to be a way to talk to everybody about climate change. Red states, blue states, conservatives, liberals. Because that 89%, it crosses all of that. We do some work with some conservative local newsrooms in the southeastern part of the United States. We help local TV in some of these conservative parts of the country figure out a way that they can talk about climate change to their audience. And they are like, they come to us and say, our audience wants this. We have to think through how can we talk to them about it in a way that doesn't turn them away. And there's a million ways to do it, and they're doing some great reporting. The final thing is, if you buy this idea, there has to be an economic model that we can figure out that makes this work. There's a few examples. The Guardian is probably the best example, and granted, they're a unique place. They have a unique audience. They're of a unique size. But their model is pay as you wish, sort of. If you read it, you get a pop-up and say, please contribute. If you don't want to, it's fine. You can keep reading the stuff. But they want you to contribute. The single largest category of contributions in terms of what is the story that prompts people to give? Environment news. Far and away. Far and away. That is what gets people to contribute. There's a few other examples. Politiker in Denmark really leaned into climate coverage and saw their audience grow significantly. France Television redid their climate coverage, really amped it up, and their audience followed. So there's examples out there, but we need to tell this story to our publishers, we need to tell the story to our business people, and we need to convince them that this is not something that they should be afraid of. Frankly, a lot of the perception around climate news is dated, and it has as much to do with the demographic of the people who are making these decisions as it does with the actual audience data. So that's it for me for now, but happy to talk more about it later.
I'm going to turn it over to Anna Bradley now. Anna is the executive director of Sentient Media, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan news organization that publishes stories on factory farming and agriculture. And Anna's going to talk to us about small independent newsrooms and the power of those.
Okay. Hi, we're part of the 89% project as well, actually. So you'll see some of our pieces on that. So thanks, Kyle and your team, for doing that. I think it's really important. So in answering this question, I think for me, I want to zoom out a little bit and talk about the gap that Sentient is trying to fill with our reporting. So when we look at climate change and environmental destruction and all of the fun stuff, we know that the way we eat, the way we farm has a huge impact. Food accounts for about a third of the greenhouse gas emissions, and most of that is driven by meat, especially beef. But when we look at climate reporting on this topic, when we look at climate reporting in general, 93% of the time, climate media in the US, this is all US-based, ignores meat. So there's basically 7% that does talk about meat. And within that, sometimes meat is, sometimes they talk about it as a solution. Sometimes they talk about switching from beef to chicken, for example. But when they say that, they don't also address the whole story. So they won't, for example, mention the animal welfare component, like what that actually means. There are 100 chickens to every one cow. And the conditions that chickens are kept in are often far, far worse than those of cows. So this is why Sentient was founded, to basically start to fill in this gap that we see in climate media and a lot of other areas. So as Madeline said, Sentient is today the only nonprofit, nonpartisan newsroom in the US solely dedicated to reporting on industrial animal agriculture. There are, of course, newsrooms who have a vertical, or like who publish the occasional pieces about this aspect of climate change. And we hosted a beat dinner last night, and some of the people are in the room today, so thank you for coming. And there are obviously brilliant reporters covering this topic and who want to cover this topic. We have grown in the last 3 years from a tiny newsroom. By the end of next month, we're going to be 18 people. There is a lot of appetite for this aspect of the climate puzzle. So the work that we do investigative journalism, solution stories, disinformation debunking, and science explainers. And we've been doing it for the last 7 years. I've been ED for 5.5. And obviously we've faced a lot of challenges during this time. And I'm going to talk about two kind of main buckets, which I think fall into trust and credibility building, essentially. I think that's been our biggest challenge. So first off, I think the line between advocacy and journalism is something that we've been navigating. I think, you know, the fact an outlet like Sentient exists, it's clear there's a issue with the food system, and we don't need to be neutral about that, but we do have to be objective. And we've done a lot of work. Jenny, our editor-in-chief, is here. You know, she's been putting in a lot of work with our editorial team to start addressing this and starting to try and build that. So we've got, for example, transparency is a very important factor for us. So we're members of Institute for Nonprofit News. We've published our editorial policy on our website. Our freelance contracts and everything is on our website. Our 990s, our donors, like everything is there and visible. The other area is editorial firewall between funders. So I maintain this firewall. So our editor-in-chief, our editorial team aren't responsible for fundraising. That's my job. And the third area is this rigorous fact-checking process. So we have a full-time fact-checker, and we have a fact-checking process that we ask all of our freelancers and all of our staff writers, obviously, to adhere to. So that's that kind of area of stuff. The second area I wanted to touch on is trust and audience development. So when I became executive director at Sentient 5.5 years ago, the audience was basically 100% animal advocates, which is great. Like, we want everybody to read our stories. But obviously, the most important thing is that our stories are read by people who are impacted by the topics that we cover. So farmers, people in rural communities, people who don't have access to clean water or clean air even. So how can you grow your audience if you're you know, lumped in with like this animal advocacy kind of bucket of readers. And again, a lot of hard work over the last, particularly the last 2.5 years since Jenny became our editor-in-chief. So a lot of hard work that's been going into that. We have finally kind of come out of that silo now. And I'll tell you, and part of that is because of collaborations, for sure. So for us, last year was our best year in terms of reach. We had 2.5 million visitors to our website, and about 80% of that was driven by organic search traffic. So basically people who are Googling questions around like climate change, around like deforestation, around food, all of that stuff. So that's what, those are the people who are mainly coming to our website. But because we are like this very niche newsroom and we're kind of like doing a niche within a niche, we have, we've also centered collaborations and partnerships and republications. So through that work, last year our stories were republished over 5,000 times, and that ended up with us reaching an audience of about 50 million people across the US. And that's people through like local radio stations, through like NPR affiliates. We did a collaboration with The Guardian and Yes Magazine and Nexus and Project Drawdown, which ended up with our stories being republished and shared. The story that was republished in The Guardian, they said it actually performed really well by their metrics. So there's even clear appetite for that. We were republished by like MSN News a whole bunch. Marlo, who is sat over here, freelanced for us and wrote a piece, it co-reported a piece for the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. So they're based in the UK, so they needed people in the US who know this beat, and Marlo did that with us, which was amazing. So I think like this is the kind of area, this is the kind of work that we've been doing to try and pull us out of the silo, to try and build credibility, to try and like tell these stories and get into like basically helping newsrooms or bolstering this kind of reporting in newsrooms so that this gap that we see in climate media is addressed. But we're doing all of this at a time, obviously, where you know there is a loss of trust, a huge loss of trust in national media, and at the same time, local newsrooms are disappearing, as you know, I don't need to tell anybody here. So one of the ways that we've been trying to focus on working with local newsrooms is a particular partnership with a group called the Public News Service. And if you don't know about them, basically what they do is they take our stories, they turn them into like 2 or 3 minute little audio clips. They'll use like the sources, interviews, and use their voices as part of the story. And then they'll distribute it across like all of their radio partners across the US. So this has been really kind of incredible for us in terms of being able to reach people on the ground who are so affected by the issues, and including them in the stories has been another really great aspect to get these messages out to people. Which has been awesome. I think they've taken just over, is Catherine here, Jenny? No. Our Director of Training and Partnerships is at the conference somewhere, but I think they've taken about 100 stories so far, and that's reached, I think, upwards of 50 million listeners, and they have this tracking system that I can talk about. But on top of that, we're also developing, with PNS, these GIS mapping tools. So what we're developing is a map of the US that demonstrates like where the factory farms are and where there's like water pollution and what radio signals, like the reach of the radio signals and where news deserts are. So we can start to kind of like build a visual where we can zoom in and be like, oh, there is this factory farm in this place where there is no media and there's no access to clean water or whatever it is, and start to target those local newsrooms and help them tell these like hyper-local, incredibly important stories. So yeah, I guess that's, you know, those are the things that we're doing to try and like make sure that we're reaching and developing like a bigger audience. We've learned a bunch. We obviously have a lot more to learn, and I'm excited to like get into the second half of this where I can hear, you know, your experiences and share more as well. But yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Anna. Those are really impressive, amazing stories. I want to think about the narrative thread that we're putting through here. So we're talking about how we answer challenges in journalism and some of the big challenges we're facing. And so one is that we need to make clear to people who invest in journalism and our publishers that there is a real desire among our audiences for information about climate change. And one is collaboration and research sharing, and one is sharing resources and building partnerships, and another sounds like it's you know, really being willing to think about how we get out to audiences and meet them where they are. So David is going to talk to us about something a little bit different, but is very closely related in a lot of ways, because we can't do these things if we're not also being aware of the kinds of online threats that we're facing and the kinds of risks that journalists are taking right now. So David Huerta is with the Freedom of the Press Foundation, and he's going to talk with us about how to have a mindset to think about how we deal with some of those threats.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. I'm David Huerta. I'm a senior digital security trainer at the Freedom of the Press Foundation. We are a small, but I would like to say small, but mighty nonprofit based out of Brooklyn, New York, formerly from San Francisco. We have a few different elements to the kind of work that we do, represented in a few different teams. Actually, show of hands, how many of you have heard of the Press Freedom Tracker? Okay, cool. So most people have. Great. So Press Freedom Tracker, of course, is sort of searchable database of attacks on journalists in the U.S. since 2017. Sort of a way to report on this sort of like encroaching sort of hostility against the press by letting us sort of like take the wheel on making journalists the story. There's also a few other teams. We have a very sort of like tech-centric element to some of our work, including a whistleblowing platform that is called SecureDrop. We think a lot about all the things that can go wrong when reaching out to whistleblowers, all the things that can go wrong when sources reach out to us. And SecureDrop is like one example of sort of the sort of extremist end of what one can build to create the safest and most guaranteed secure anonymity possible platform we can think of, knowing the kind of surveillance that we can anticipate growing over the next several years. It's not perfect, and it takes maintenance, it takes an IT team to really set up, but it is a product that we put a lot of energy into, knowing that like this may be a thing where we may have it as sort of a nice to have, but we know that in the future this may become more of a need to have. The other thing that we do, going into sort of like my team, I work on a digital security education team, which helps journalists learn how to protect their work, protect their sources, protect themselves from any number of online attacks. And that can have a very, very wide spectrum of things to consider. And we're not going to go into like every single thing everybody should do bit by bit. There's a lot of wonderful resources that are included in that QR code that you can check out afterwards. But there's a few different things that I think are on the top of my mind on the horizon. For many people, I feel like there's certain canaries in the coal mines or certain rubrics that people use to sort of detect when a certain sort of runaway towards authoritarianism has happened. So for some people, that was like Gulf of America. For us, it was, and you can read the reporting on it on the Press Freedom Tracker, that was the raid of the Marion County Record in Marion, Kansas in August 11th, 2023. So in this case, well before the election, but a rubric that we've always considered that in the U.S. there has been no precedent for a newsroom being raided by a government, whether local, federal, or otherwise. But in this case, that was the moment where we kind of realized a certain rubric had been passed. And if you look at the very harrowing audio recording from that happening, you see basically, or you hear officers going in, going up to a computer saying, it's not encrypted, we're good to go. And then because of that, having an avenue to extract every single file, every single bit of data that existed on that computer, every single communication email with sources, browser history, everything else that one would have on a computer or laptop available to them. And I think I bring this up as an example partially because I feel like there's a lot of issues that are on the top of people's minds as we consider things like stories about cross-border investigations, border crossings, how to safely think through the idea that your computer or your phone, other devices might get seized. And it is scary, but I also, you know, I think it is important to remind people that in many ways, like, all that is old is new again. Like, we have been here before, and encryption does work. Like, the elements that we need to address the problems that have been thought about since like the 90s, like exist now and are available for all of you to use. And I would love nothing more than to show you exactly how to do that. That's kind of my...
All right, thanks, David. So you've given us a third ingredient here in our project of building more sustainable journalism, which is tools to keep ourselves safe, especially in a moment when we have additional threats and we have to be mindful of those. So, and I realize these are very diverse areas that people are talking about, and that's by design. We wanted to give you kind of a menu of different kinds of ideas and tools that we can use to brainstorm in the second part. So if it feels like we're going in a lot of different directions, that's why. They're all different aspects of how we make journalism more sustainable and how we keep ourselves thriving in this, you know, or at least safe in this industry. Our fourth speaker is Valeria Fernandez, who is working, has founded a project called Altavoz Labs, and hang on a second, I want to remember what question we asked her to answer. This was, how do we support reporters and freelancers in getting their work to the audiences that need to hear them? And I just also want to say that Valeria's done a lot of really amazing work, both with freelancers and just with supporting reporters and doing work in a lot of different communities. So, yeah.
Hi, everybody. Can you hear me well? Okay, I definitely want to learn how to encrypt this computer and my phone, so please, hopefully there is a handout with like, okay, amazing. So I'm originally from Uruguay, but based here in Arizona since forever, and literally like 25 years, and I've been surviving the heat. And I want to tell you a little bit about sort of how the organization that I founded came about, because there's a couple of components. It's the intersection of community journalism, writing for immigrant communities, and also freelancing and how freelancing looks like as a person of color, as an immigrant person. I started here in Arizona back in 2003 at a small paper called La Voz. We wrote for immigrant communities. We wrote in Spanish. But it was like a bit of a tortilla factory, you know, produce 15 stories a week, one after the other. And it was a great frustration for me and a lot of my colleagues that wanted to do more accountability journalism, figuring out ways on how to carve the time. The staff, you know, our wonderful editors were also overworked. And there wasn't anybody that you could turn to be able to do that story that the paper of record was doing. And they were doing it differently because they were writing about your community and not for it. So that was one of the things at the core of why I created Altavoz Lab, to provide support to local community journalists working with these audiences, immigrant audiences, people of color, to give them mentorship, to give them funding, to be able to lead in those projects that they otherwise wouldn't be able to do. But the other component enters freelancing. A lot of these local, some of them, you know, there's no one size fits all. These publications are very diverse, right? Some of them are working primarily with freelancers, right? Freelancers are really the backbone of journalism, but, you know, underpaid, burned out, lack of insurance, lack of safety, you name it. I mean, there's great actors, but a lot of them are really exposed, and they're exiting journalism because of the toll that it takes, and it's just simply not affordable, or taking jobs at Uber or flower shops. I mean, I know them. So we consider that in our model as well. And in the type of fellowship that we extend, we try to make them fair, to provide fair compensation, and to also consider, you know, is it feasible to ask this of the reporter? So we are very people-centered in this model that we created to try to address the gap which we see in support for local community journalists that are so pivotal because of that relationship of trust that they have with their audiences. It's not for us so much about the numbers of how many people are you going to reach, but it's more about the quality of that relationship that the publication and the reporter has with that audience. In 2023, you know, we're very small. We partner with Environmental Health Sciences that has the publication Environmental Health News to do something a bit out of our comfort zone, which is to do reporting that had to do specifically on the petrochemical industry, specifically in Texas, and on the impact that that industry was having on immigrant communities. So we had the resources and we said, do we do this, do we not? Let's experiment and see what can happen with a very focused, targeted fellowship. So the result of that was a new sort of experiment, because we ended up partnering with a big outlet like the Texas Tribune, is one of their staff reporters, and a local freelancer that was working for La Esquina de Texas and a number of other smaller Spanish publications to produce a story that will reach that specific immigrant audience. So I hope to be able to talk about these in the workshop a little bit more. But there were some really interesting lessons that came out from the project. You know, it's like dancing salsa. When you have a partnership like that, there's always going to be someone that's going to be leading, right? So part of our exploration is trying to figure out, we don't have the whole answer, but it's how do we make those collaborations fair, especially to the freelancers, who, when a project like this one takes a huge life of its own and it becomes longer, but it's really wordy and you have to continue, end up maybe working more than they should, right, when you extend a fellowship. So in our new alliterations, we are working on that, on being able to support freelancers better when collaborations take place, and also build sort of safeguards. So the larger organizations, when a partnership happens, become aware, because there's a lot of need of that sort of institutional awareness of their work. And also the importance of the community engagement aspect of the partnership, as in, look, if you publish in Spanish, even though you believe your audience is mostly in English, you are also reaching out the cousins, the daughters of other, you know, of people in that community that are immigrants. We're also sharing work from your publication, so you shouldn't discard the possibility of doing that. Sorry, I'm rambling a little bit on that. But going back to one of the key lessons that we learned was the engagement. How valuable it was for the reporters to begin thinking about engagement, not when the reporting was done, but at the very beginning, trying to understand how are we going to get this precious information on the petrochemical industry, the failures of the monitoring system on the quality of air that was mostly in English. How are we going to get that info to a Spanish-speaking immigrant community that doesn't really have a paper of record there, that doesn't read the Texas Tribune, and that, you know, is relying mostly on word of mouth, social media, and that sort of stuff. So we started there, and then with the amazing audience engagement team of the Texas Tribune, we devised a plan to go back to the community, create, you know, a lot of people are doing postcards, but yes, we did the postcards with the bilingual information, a QR code to find a story, and also we recorded that story in Spanish, so people that don't have time to read, you know, a 4,000-word article, can actually listen to it while they're doing other activities. Kind of podcast style, but on a lower budget. And it was amazing for reporter Wendy Selene Perez and Alejandra Martinez from the Tribune to get the feedback from the community. Like, people come and go. They come, they interview us. We never get to read the story because it's in English. And they never come back to talk to us, right? So, by the way, this engagement was done also in collaboration with a Houston Air Alliance. So they had a local organization that was partnering with them. But it was so meaningful for the community and for the reporters to sort of see the fruit of their labor and the connection. A few lessons, because I don't know, time flies when you're talking, right? Do I have 1-2 minutes or?
You have a couple minutes, yeah.
Yeah. Now that our organization is growing and we're getting larger grants, we're going to apply some of those lessons learned. And I literally lose sleep about this, about the formula, the best formula to be able to support and not become a burden when you give a fellowship to a small publication or a journalist, right? One component that we're going to incorporate is funding for the audience engagement, not as a cute thing that is flashy and exciting, but like really engaging the reporters in the process of creating these and building these. If the sky was the limit, what would you create? Is it a meeting in the library? Is it going into the public buses and engaging local campuses like Borderless Magazine does in Chicago? You pay a team of people that are like promotores, and they go around to key places to share the story. What is it going to take? So more funding for that, more money for the reporters. And also, how do we also evaluate the condition of the publication? Are we placing an extra burden by giving this amazing fellowship with mentorship to, but then it turns out the editor is also a freelancer and they're overworked. And so there's not a one size fit all to these fellowships, but I think to just start having the conversations and thinking in that direction and recognizing that maybe each of them is a one of a kind is important. I think I was hearing from a freelancer the other day as we are trying to develop, and we are fundraising, a visual fellowship for a local community journalist, a person of color, immigrant, is, you know, there's a lot of wonderful fellowships out there, but sometimes you are like attached to a newsroom that has a toxic environment and is not really through no fault of their own, like the whole ecosystem is suffering, right? But it's really, really hard for the freelancer to all of a sudden, you know, they're almost trapped in the situation. So it's not as easy. It's really beautiful to say, oh, we have all this money to give. But then the real work begins to see, is it really serving the journalists that we want to serve? And is this healthy? And is this really fair for them? And I just, you know, want to bring that to the forefront. And I'm really eager to hear about ideas of cool fellowships that you have seen. And again, I just want to reiterate, we want to invest in people and place. The journalists that are already living in the community who have this very key component, which is the passion and the commitment. And they may be a little bit rough on the edges, but that's fine. What I think is key here is that relationship and investing in place. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Valeria. I love how you're thinking about the different dynamics that reporters face and sort of thinking about how we address the sort of sustainability at all these different levels. We are having this first hour is shorter than the normal panel is 75 minutes, right? We're doing this part of the discussion in an hour. So that means I'm going to open it up for Q&A in just a moment. But I want to ask just one quick question, which is part of the goal of this session is to bring people together to try to think about really simple fixes, like some small thing that they could do together, or some small resource they could tap into to make something happen that's actually very important or transformative or useful or makes their lives easier. I'm wondering if each of you have an example of something like that from your work, some little solution that was like, wow, this is great.
I would just say from our perspective and everybody has talked about this, is the power of collaboration. We're in an industry that's collapsing. We're declining. But we can counter that by teaming up with each other. And I still see sort of vestigial resistance for people who say we don't want to, we don't want to work with other people. We want to protect our scoop. We want to blah, blah, blah. And that's just not the way of the world anymore. And it's less of a problem with freelancers than it is legacy news organizations, which are really terrible about this. And that's a lot of what we spend our time fighting.
Yeah, I feel like I have so many different, very useful things one can do to take action on digital security, kind of in that domain. But if I could pick a topic that I didn't really touch on too much in this panel, but that I worked with others on a workshop on Wednesday, is that online harassment is still very much a thing. And as we report on the environment and sort of expose some very uncomfortable realities, like, we're going to get a lot of people coming at us. And there are fortunately a lot of ways to mitigate some of those risks. There's things like data broker delisting services. So if your personal information is just publicly searchable, you can choose to have a service that will let you opt out, for example. Consumer Reports has done a lot of reporting on this. There's also some great guides from Pen America on the same subject. So I definitely recommend checking those out.
Yeah, I think for us, like, this actually came up on our preparation call as well. One of the things for us was around republications and what that kind of does for freelancers. Because for me, I'm like, yay, we got republished. We got all these readers. I'm so happy. But for a freelancer, it's like, well, you paid me for this story, but now it's like in The Guardian or whatever. Like, that's wasn't part of the deal. We spoke about this, and since SEJ last year, where we started like realizing like, oh wait, yeah, that's a huge oversight. We've now got a policy where we pay extra when a story gets picked up. And that information again is on our website. So you can see what the details are of that, but yeah.
I think that like one of the lessons for us is just like, follow the collaboration to where it leads you. I mean, you're going to be pivoting, and no collaboration is going to be the same as another collaboration. You take those lessons learned. It's obviously really cool if you could start a collaboration with someone that you already know. It's hard to jump blindly into something. Not long ago, I was the managing editor of Palabra, by the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, dedicated to working with freelancers. And we did a collaboration with the Hesington Report that focuses on education. And, I mean, we started from scratch, but roles were clearly defined, right? There was a lead editor. So sometimes, and I heard this advice from the Pulitzer Center, right? Try not to duplicate, not to have two of two on a project, but really, like, create a project of its own that everybody kind of belongs to. So it's not so much about, you know, what is in it for me, but what is for the better of the project. So.
Okay, so I'm gonna open it up to, we have a few minutes for some questions. And as per the usual policy, I need to remind you that SEJ members and journalists ask first. Please identify yourself. And, try to make it a straightforward question rather than having a long preamble beforehand. So, and I can also run over here with a microphone.
Hello, Wudan Yan, independent journalist. I have a question for those of you working on collaborative news models. In the lunch session, Aline Brown pointed to the fact that a dollar a word pretty much is the should be the floor for freelance pay. And I think in the general conversation about sustainability, when you work on partnership models, like, are you comfortable? And maybe there are people in this room who want to open that up as an option to their newsrooms or start something new. Would you feel comfortable sharing actual numbers as to how much people get paid once pieces are republished for more impact and more reach?
So Jenny, our editor-in-chief, will know the latest numbers. Like,
say the exact number. Yeah. You're saying, like, in the future, basically, would we put that... Are you saying, either way, like, it varies by story, but I've worked on increasing our rates, you know, as we go and try to make them kind of project-based, basically. It's around, I usually pay, like, between $350 to $500 and up for a story, but usually try to keep it on the shorter side. I was a freelancer myself, you know, so, like, I in the beginning, the rates were lowered. It was like, this has got to change. So we've been working on it. And like, basically we work with fewer freelancers so I can pay more. And yeah, like, and so then with the syndication, I believe it's, I should know this off the top of my head, I'm sorry, we just kind of instituted it like a month ago. It is on our site, so someone can fact check me. But it's something like 25 for every republication. And the thing is, sometimes we get a lot of those, so we were trying to kind of make it sustainable for us. But we're open to, you know, like working on our rates. I've been working on them since I started. So, and I think, you know, the more transparency, the better. That was part of having the contract on the site. And yeah, I mean, it's because my budgets have grown every year, which has been great. So we're trying to make it as sustainable for freelancers as much as we can. How long? I'm usually it would be like the 350 would be like under 1,000 words. So it would be something like if we're doing like 450, 500, it's, you know, maybe like 1,100. Like I'll try to keep it shorter. And I also sometimes will another way I was able to kind of negotiate for freelancers is be like, okay, we're gonna do this story this many words, and if I know it's an experienced freelancer, especially that I've worked with before, like if I've worked with you once, I'll say like, okay, we'll just do one round of edits. That's gonna save your time. So I kind of try to like cut, you know, I try to make it as good as I can wherever I can, essentially. When we learn, Amy Westervelt is the person I think who suggested this whole, you know, paying per syndication. So part of like coming to these conferences is like we learn, and I'm like, great suggestion, we'll do it, you know.
Thank you. Hi. Enjoyed this panel. I want to ask about how you deal with some of your freelancers or reporters who are in the field and getting violently attacked, whether their rented car tires are slashed or they're being followed at night. And I'm talking about in places like Utah or Nevada or Eastern California. First of all, do you see an increase in this? And second, what do you do to support your staff out there?
Oh, did you identify yourself?
Oh, sorry.
Just tell people your name. I know, but just tell people your name.
Sorry, I'm Kathleen Sharp with The Guardian.
What's that?
No. You should go first because You're really the expert on this.
So most of what I work with is more online safety, so I can't speak with real authority on physical safety, but I would say that there are a lot of great resources out there for people wanting to get what is called, I think, HEFAT training, which is sort of this training that journalists can get to learn how to deal with high-intensity situations like kidnappings, for example. And some of these programs are available to some groups that offer sort of a scholarship-based offerings of these. So I think IWMF offers HEFAT trainings here and there, so that might be something to look into. Yep.
I've got one very, very quick thing.
The only area that I would suggest is Reporters Shield. So check them out. We've applied, and yeah, I'm waiting to get in there, so I can't say much more, but it seems like a good place. David nodded, it's good, okay.
When I was working at Palabra, we weren't experiencing at that time, you know, that sort of threat. But currently, right now in Altavoz Lab, as we launch our fellowships, we're trying to build in trainings, and I'm actually involved with a university in trying to provide a very specific training on safety for immigrant journalists that I think it's in Spanish is slightly different than what it might be, you know, for someone if you were born here, right? At first, the conversation was, oh, we're concerned about our undocumented reporters because there are out there, or the ones that have DACA. But now it's like also, yeah, people that have a green card you could be covering something, you're outside of school, there is an action that happens and you're either profiled and you're taken, or you are harassed by someone during a protest, and then you end up also getting detained, and then what's going to happen to you if that particular local authority doesn't like you and wants to turn you over to immigration, even though you have, you're a green card holder. So it's an area that in the conversations I've been having, there's still a lot of need for more support for those reporters and talking to them. They're asking for it. And also, you know, as a sidebar, the mental health, this is really taking a toll. I mean, on everybody, every journalist, right? But when you specifically look in a certain way and your family is directly impacted and your friends, it really hits you. And they're desperately wanting for that support. I know there was some training here that was in English, but there's a big need also. I mean, I take the opportunity to just bring that up. And we're looking for attorneys that can specialize on this area, on the intersection of freedom of speech and immigration status. Yeah.
I just also want to mention, and it's in the resource guide, so the Open Notebook has done something very simple that I think is very powerful, which is that they've set up a website that you can fill out if you're crossing the U.S. border, if you're a journalist. It's, as I said, it's in the resource guide. Please do not post it to social media because they don't want to get overwhelmed. But you put your name and details in, and they'll check in with you before you cross and after you cross and make sure that you actually got through. And if you didn't, they'll try to communicate to people who can help you. So that's I bring it up not just because it's connected to what we were just talking about, but also because I think it's an amazing example of something really powerful that's very simple that we can do together that is just what we're hoping to try to get out today. And I see one more hand, and I'm gonna, this is gonna be our last question. I feel really bad about cutting it short, but we have this whole other part planned, and I wanna make sure we have time, plenty of time for it, so.
Well, I was just gonna say, if this ends up being a better question for the second half, feel free to cut me off, so let me know. My name is Ethan Friedman, I'm a freelancer. I think, as a lot of freelancers would be able to attest, our lives revolve around some very fundamental math that gets complicated, right? We have to think about how much time do I have? How much time is this assignment gonna take? And how much are they paying me? And when you sort of work those variables together, you end up figuring out whether you can do that kind of work or not. And it gets a little bit more complicated, right? Because we also have time where we're reading our emails that is not paid, where we are filling out our taxes or sending our invoices that is not paid, where we are out in the world looking for stories or reading scientific papers or calling up people we think are interesting to maybe find something that we could sell for work that is also not paid. And I think a lot of us can also attest that the fundamentals of how that math works out is that it... What? Yeah, no, yes, is how it doesn't work, essentially, is the point, is where we're at right now. And I've seen in my own life where I'm now doing less and less journalism and doing more and more non-journalism because it's good and it's steady. And so I think one thing I would love to know, maybe in this section or in the next hour as we get into it, is thinking about not just providing more resources for freelancers, but providing some sense of stability for freelancers so that we can do the sort of long work it takes to be a journalist, the sort of iterative work. I don't know if you have any strategies or ideas on how to make that process work on a longer term scale as opposed to assignment by assignment.
Okay, so I both think that is a really great transition to the next session, and I'll give, I think maybe Valeria or Anna might have a quick, semi-quick answer to this. The quick version, and then you'll have a chance to talk more about it.
I was just going to very quickly say that the only thing that we've done in that, obviously we're aware, and like Jenny said, she was a freelancer before she came in, but for us, I think that if it's like a big investigative or a longer piece, then I would hope that we pay a better fee, and we would assume that would kind of cover some of that groundwork that you've already done. So for a big piece, it would be, you know, up to $1,000 probably is what we've done in the past. But yeah.
Yeah, you're super right, and I was answering your question. Yeah, it doesn't work. I know it because I did it, right? And you take on all different things that you can, and you use everything that you got, every single skill to make freelancing work. I think is you know, one fellowship is not going to be the answer, although fellowship can help and they can give us some life by allowing us to focus on something and have a steady stability. But I also think it's an overall conversation for the industry too about understanding when you set your rates, really how much really goes to that freelancer. So it's not like $200 or $400 per story that goes to them. And, you know, we're coming to rely on freelancers a lot for a lot of stuff, and they don't have liability insurance. So it's like a big question that needs to change, not just from the freelancer trying to hustle better, I guess, but also from the industry really recognizing that. And I don't know, maybe we got to create like a huge endowment for freelancers that, you know, there are people that have money, so.
All right, so now your task is to create a huge endowment. Now, now we're gonna move into the second part. I'm gonna introduce my collaborator here, Michael Bradbury, and he's gonna explain how that's gonna work.
Thank you to Madeline and to our panelists, Kyle, David, Anna, and Valeria. Let's give them a hand. Okay, now that we've talked about the wide-ranging components to this workshop, we're going to get specific. And so in just a minute, we're going to actually take a little break, because I know we've been sitting here. It's the end of the day. I want to acknowledge that we've been like getting a fire hose of information over the last 3 days, and I, for one, am pretty exhausted, and this is the last thing. So thank you so much for sticking with us and engaging with us in this sort of grand experiment. So after our break, we're going to break into four groups. The room will be set into four different areas of the room, and we'll have five guides who will lead you through the next part of the conversation. So I'm going to read a description and some guiding questions for each of the groups, and then we're going to take that break. So think about which group you'd like to join, and I think we probably have a number of people, so we can have about 8 or 9 in each group. So kind of go where what group calls to you. So the first group, which will be up here in this corner, will be building sustainable business models for environmental journalism. And some of the guiding questions to think about, or maybe these are things you're already thinking about. What are some innovative business models like co-ops and collective advertising to make legacy nonprofit or independent newsrooms more sustainable? What partnerships and collaborations can we form to support a better environmental journalism ecosystem? And what steps are needed to start your own independent newsroom or form a freelance cooperative? That's going to be led by Amelia Ascari, a lecturer in the program in the environment at the University of Michigan, and we'll also include our panelist, Kyle Pope. So Amelia, will you wave? She's back there, and she will be up here at that point. Okay, and the second one is going to be nourishing and supporting reporters and freelancers through innovative funding models and other resources. The guiding questions there are, how can we better retain environmental journalists, keep freelancers fed, train new or young reporters, find funding beyond just the fees we are paid for articles, and measure the impact of our reporting? Also, what are models for funding that would make reporting more sustainable? That will be co-led by Karen Coates, the fellowship editor at Manga Bay, and Marissa Ortega-Welch, the science and environmental journalist and reporter and editor at KALW Public Media. This group will also include panelist Valeria Fernandez. So Karen and Marissa, please wave. And they will be in that back corner. Okay, so our third group, tools for reaching audiences. In a moment when the public is increasingly distrustful, disengaged, and less willing to pay for or even read the news, how do we find ways to reach them? What are innovative storytelling strategies for infiltrating news deserts or captivating engaged audiences? What support is available to journalists to expand their reach, co-report, or republish stories in different media or different geographic areas? And that group is going to be led by Steve Sapienza, the senior editor for U.S. News Partnerships at the Pulitzer Center, and also include panelist Anna Bradley. So Steve, will you raise your hand? He's over there. He's got his name tag. Perfect, perfect. And Steve's group will be in this corner in the front of the room. And our fourth group will be tools for facing legal and online threats. Online harassment, doxing, and other threats make being an environmental journalist very challenging. In the U.S., those threats are growing day by day. What can you do individually, and can we do collectively to protect ourselves and each other? What legal protections do we need to have at our disposal, and how do we access them when needed? This is going to be led by Susan Swanberg, an associate professor at the University of Arizona School of Journalism, and will also include panelist David Huerta. So Susan, will you wave your hand? Great. And Susan will be in that back corner as well. Okay, so we're going to take a break. Probably let's do it 5 minutes if you guys can manage that. And the room will look a little different when you come back. Please get into your group. And there are also going to be pastries in the back. So we'll give you a little sugar to support the next section. Thank you.